Hi, I'm RJ Bardsley, partner and co-CEO at Wireside Communications. Welcome to This Side of the Wire, a podcast focused on the intersection of communications and technology. In each episode, we'll meet some of the most fascinating people in the tech industry. We'll get their perspectives on how tech is changing society, the economy, and the environment. We'll learn what makes them tick and how they see the future. Tune in as we decode the complexities of the digital age and uncover the stories behind the innovations, the innovators, and how they're transforming our lives. Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us on This Side of the Wire. Today, we're thrilled to have Peter Podrema, the CMO of Arch Painting and Paint-A-Zen, with us. In this episode, East and West, the Emerging Divide in Technology, we're exploring the growing divide between technological development in China and the West. For years, it looked like technology was bridging cultural gaps between China and the US, but that started to shift towards the middle of the last decade. Today, everything from the phones we use to the chips that power data centers are increasingly different. Joining me today, Peter is a seasoned global marketing leader and strategist. He's had a successful career spearheading global communications and marketing efforts, including leading agencies such as Racepoint Global, Boston Digital, and Boathouse. Peter has worked in Asia, the US, and Europe, and has spent some time in Washington, D.C. as well. Peter, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Good to be here and great to see you again, RJ.
Likewise. I should mention to everyone who's listening that Peter was a mentor of mine for many, many years, and I've worked with him for about two decades in a past life. So, Peter, let's start with a little bit of an introduction. Tell us a little bit about your background and specifically your experience working in technology across China and the US.
Sure. So I came into technology, PR, and tech marketing during the internet boom and rode that wave and really enjoyed it. And in the early 2000s, I helped to start a company that was focused on reimagining what PR could be like. And we added social and digital to the equation and eventually rolled that up into something that we felt was pretty unique. And I became the CEO of that company. And that was called Racepoint Global. And part of our strategy there initially was how do we move ourselves into China and start to appeal to the large technology brands that were starting to dominate the global landscape. Out of Beijing and Shanghai and Shenzhen. As we started to try and do that work, what became clear to us was that it was more effective to help those companies to start to penetrate the rest of the world. And so the strategy became, how do we help Chinese companies to grow a presence in the U.S.? And that involved public relations and public affairs and some government affairs as well. And in the process of that, I had the chance to work alongside RJ in many instances with some of the most exciting brands who are doing incredibly innovative things, whether it be chip makers or mobile devices or infrastructure technology. And what I saw was an economy that was really driving itself forward and moving out of the industrial sort of approach that had been China to that point into the information economy. And over the course of our work there, what became apparent to me, particularly because I had worked in public policy as well, was that there were a great deal of friction points, there were cultural differences, and there was also, at that point, the beginning of a focus in the U.S. that drew us away from advancing our interests in things like chip technology and some of the infrastructure technologies that are going to be really the oil that greases the gears of the 21st century economy. What I'm happy to see is, over the last 3 or 4 years, particularly in the last administration, a refocusing on what a technology strategy ought to look like in the U.S. and how companies can evolve and be globally dominant. Some of that has come at the expense, I think, of our relationships with China. Some of that is bad. Some of it won't be bad because I do think it's driving a new kind of innovation. But more generally, what I see is a future with a bifurcated sort of approach to technology in the East and the West.
That's interesting. I'm reading a lot about that too. How would you characterize this gap?
I think it starts as a national security issue and then it becomes a competitive issue as well. So I don't think there's ever been a time in my lifetime where national security and economic competition were so intertwined. during the Soviet era, we had a national security issue, but they were not necessarily producing, the Soviets were not necessarily producing the kinds of technology or goods and services that competed with the United States at scale. The Chinese are. And what we know is that we have two very different visions for what the future of the world is. And those models are not always compatible. And so I think as a result, particularly as it relates to national security, you're going to see more and more inward-facing sort of decisions being made by the government. And technology makers are going to have to adapt with respect to that. You saw recently, as recently as today, the Commerce Department did a large deal doling out CHIPS Act money to an American maker. And I think we see more of that happening. You're going to start to see, again, more of that separation shaped around national security.
When you look back, I know you talked a little bit about your early days at Racepoint and your early days working with Chinese companies. Where exactly did this gap start? Where do you see the seeds of this gap?
I think it began a long time ago with the U.S. giving up so much manufacturing and then later giving up on infrastructure technology. So you saw the rise of companies like Huawei, as you saw companies like Cisco sort of fading to the background. And I think, you know, the government and policymakers in the U.S. started to be, and in the EU for that matter, started to become increasingly focused on should they be making those acquisitions from what many consider to be Chinese government-backed companies. And so there's now a push, or there has been a sustained push, I think, as relations have sort of deteriorated a bit between the U.S. and China, to start to bring some of that that technology back on shore. I think the other part of it is the pandemic fundamentally changed everything. So it may not have been specific to technology, but it has fundamentally changed the way Americans and people around the rest of the world think about themselves. And you're seeing it in the politics that are evolving in various parts of the world, you know, much more inward focused in many instances. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but it is a true thing. And so as a result, you know, you're going to see technology policy and technology innovation and manufacturing follow suit.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting as I listen to you kind of talk about this, I'm hearing a lot about sort of the political side. And I agree. I think, you know, there's a, by and large, most of this comes from that. But I can remember being in China a lot, and just sort of the cultural, the consumer was different, and the consumer demand, what they wanted was different. They wanted, you know, I can remember everybody in WeChat and how WeChat sort of seeped into everything in life. And I remember there were differences in consumer demand. Do you think any of this is spurred on by sort of very different consumer mindsets, in that the technology that they want might be different, or the customs of I don't know, just kind of throwing it out there.
I'm not sure necessarily. I think people tend to experience things largely the same way. At least my observations on the ground in the times I've been in China are that, you know, the consumption habits tend to be reflective of the consumption habits we have here in the U.S. And, you know, I think mobile phones and mobile devices fundamentally rewired the way everybody consumes information and accesses their purchasing decisions and takes action. I think that tends to cross borders. With respect to specific apps, you have one culture that is really focused on consolidating the experience under single providers in China, whereas here I think you have had a history of technologies sort of being separate from one another. Some would argue for security purposes, others would argue, you know, due to competitive advantage. And so some of that's become embedded in the culture. But with guys like Elon Musk, who are talking about building, you know, massive multifunction apps and experiences, that may change in the U.S. as well. Ultimately, I think, you know, what's going to drive the evolution of technology in both places is going to be the individual preferences of the markets at one level, but I do think the psychology and behavior of people at another.
Yeah, I would not make it a habit to bet against Elon Musk, but I don't think we'll ever have a super app in the U.S. the way that I've seen it in other parts of the world. But like I said, he's pretty much made everything else he wanted to come true. So,
yeah, I mean, I think we're at an interesting hinge point in our politics, and that we're sort of gone back to the era of the robber barons in many ways. If you look at the turn of the 20th century, the robber barons really were the ones who funded things like wars. You know, now you have so much accumulated wealth under a single handful of individuals that their ability to influence public policy is almost to that same level. And so I wouldn't put it past any individual to be able to sort of influence the evolution of an integrated technology app that could transform the way we behave. I look at the transformation of just the interaction and the behavior and the culture of a Twitter and now an X. And over the course of 2 years, you've seen a fundamental shift in the way people consume and access that information, how they choose to engage with one another. So the idea of getting people acclimated to a super app, who knows?
Yeah. Now, you mentioned something about the Soviet Union, and I was thinking about that too earlier when I was putting together some thoughts for this episode. One of the things about the US and USSR's competition was that it spurred a lot of innovation. I mean, you take the space race, for instance, and that's a whole two, maybe even two and a half, 3 decades of innovation that happened that might not have happened if you didn't have that sort of political competition. Is there a silver lining here when we're talking about sort of an East versus West technology experience? Is this sort of our new space race? Is this something that could spur competition or innovation globally?
I think so. I think, you know, there are industrial policies, for example, like the CHIPS Act, like the Inflation Reduction Act, that were passed in the case of the Inflation Reduction Act for a different reason. It might have been a backdoor way to move clean technology forward. But the CHIPS Act was sort of a direct response to the need for a national security measure around the production of chips and then bring it back into the U.S., which in turn drives sort of competitive spirit and a set of behaviors around innovation. If you had asked me 5, 6, 7 years ago whether or not we had the foresight in the U.S. to do that kind of thing, I would have said no, because the global economy model was working extremely well for us. I think, you know, some of the friction that came out of the tariff regime under the first Trump administration, and then, you know, some of the perceptual stuff that evolved and some of the real behavioral changes that occurred as a result of the pandemic have fueled an innovation and an innovative spirit again here in the U.S. that I didn't necessarily expect 4 or 5 years ago. 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was a foregone conclusion that the Chinese economy would eclipse America's in the 2030s. Now, I think it may never happen. Or if it does, it will be much further away than that. That doesn't mean the Chinese are not being innovative in their approach as well, because, you know, if you'd asked me 4 or 5 years ago if Huawei was going to survive, I'd have said no. And here they are, dominating again. And so at one level, you say to yourselves, this has occurred because of a number of negative reasons, and the outcomes could be negative because we're getting competitive around things that could lead to hostilities. Takeover of Taiwan, for example, or, you know, some sort of action by our own government that causes some kind of friction. But on the other hand, I think it has spurred a new level of innovation. I think you layer on the politics of this country right now and where that sort of technology elite sees the next administration and future administrations beyond that going. And all of a sudden you have, you know, this talk of a crypto regime that, you know, I wouldn't have believed possible even a year ago. Absolutely. Skeptical, but we'll see.
One of the things I was reading right before we jumped on this call was I was reading about the shift in trade and how China used to be the U.S.'s number one trading partner, and now Mexico is, and you're seeing a huge influx of trade from India as well. How do you think this could potentially affect innovation in other countries, like innovation in India, for instance, or Mexico, or maybe even the European Union?
It's an interesting question, because I'm not sure that moving the fulfillment parts of the business into these geographies causes them to innovate any more quickly, because, you know, the easy thing to do, or not the easy thing, but the obvious thing to do is to make the money based on fulfilling and manufacturing and pushing out the end product. But, you know, if you sort of believe in the power of innovation, it should result in enhancing innovation in those geographies as well. I mean, look, we've, over the last 50, 80 years, brought 1 billion people out of poverty in parts of the world where they weren't before. There's this whole sort of negative spirit around whether or not the liberal model of Western capitalism can actually function. The reality is we affected more than 1 billion people in the world and did bring them out of poverty on that model. And so, you know, who's to say what the unintended consequences of the next generation will be? I do think you touch on an interesting point, though, which is the version of reshoring that's occurring is putting it, you know, a safer distance from us than before the pandemic when we were looking for things to come from China. Because you think about inflation and the transportation disruptions and things of that nature, but also it sort of lets us turn a blind eye to the fact that this could be a larger sort of set of ongoing friction between the U.S. and China than, you know, by putting it in Mexico, you can kind of sort of say, well, it was actually a structural choice based on convenience when in fact it's a structural choice based on something else.
So my last question for you on this topic really is, what's the end game here? Do you see this as being like a temporary 10, 15 year thing and that kind of arcs back together? Or do you see this as sort of this growing branch of trees and in 150 years from now, we'll be living on almost two planets in one?
I think it's probably the latter, and there might be a third planet too, because we don't know what the unanticipated stuff is that's going to happen and what other economies might emerge. I think the other part of it is, what do certain private industrialists do? So, you know, before taking this position, I was actually working for the last year helping somebody to operationalize a blockchain technology into a series of apps that allowed for greater privacy and for you to own your own data. Now, that's a big and audacious thing when you think about replacing the World Wide Web with something like that. But inevitably, something will evolve that will sort of change things, and that will be at the hands of a group of individuals within this economy as opposed to a nation or a state. And, you know, that's another interesting dimension of it. And the concentration of capital that does exist with guys like Bezos and Musk and a handful of others is also going to have massive influence on how that happens. And the ecosystems that exist within private equity is another wild card. So I think it's going to come from many, many different places. I think it's going to be interesting to see how public policy aligns with that, because I'll go back to something that's been a passion of mine for the last 8 or 10 years, which is, how do you then transform that opportunity into something that creates equality or equality of opportunity for people across various parts of the American economy? You know, as we get further away from the 50s and 60s, where everybody had a factory job and there was this notion of the greater good, libertarianism has sort of taken over how we think about things as a nation. And so as a result, I'm not sure you can ever get that lightning in a bottle back. And the best story of it I read, and I'm off on a tangent, but it's an interesting sort of point of view, was there was CHIPS Act money being used to build a plant in a rural part of Ohio that had voted largely for Donald Trump in 2020. And the Wall Street Journal interviewed a number of people in the proverbial diner that everybody goes to in every election season, and asked them, were they happy that this factor was going up, which was going to pay six figures to people who lived in that community? And the answer was no, you weren't happy, because it was taking up farmland. And so, you know, I think we as a nation need to start to adjust to what the future of competitiveness looks like, because ultimately, if we don't, you're going to continue to have this model where the coasts are dominant. There's resentment that grows across the rest of the country around the lack of opportunity, and we're going to wind up caving in on ourselves, let alone what external countries are doing.
Getting awfully close to hillbilly allergy there.
No, but round version of it, right?
Hey, I want to take just a minute and ask you about what you're up to, because I know you recently made a move. You're the CMO now of Arch and Paynton. Tell me a little bit about what you're up to.
Yeah, absolutely. So I spent the better part of the last 30 years as a consultant in marketing and communications and in the agency world. And one of my passions had been to go in-house. I happened to be on the board of this company. And as I got to know the players better here, and they got to know me a little bit better, we found that there were some mutual synergies, and they invited me on to help them to sort of evolve their marketing strategy as the company goes sort of to that next level. What Arch is a long established painting contracting company with roots nationally that is doing quite well. What was also interesting to me was the founders and the CEO here had a point of view about what technology could do to optimize this industry as well. So this is not an industry that is typically governed by technology. It's much more traditional in its approaches, but they had acquired a platform called Paynton, which applies technology to allow people to sort of engage and create relationships and to contract services and to accelerate the delivery of a painting experience. And so we are in the process of bringing that to market more aggressively in 2025. And so I'm sort of having the fun job of sitting at the nexus point of helping to evolve a traditional brand, even as we create a new brand that is technology driven and that we think is going to be transformative for the industry.
Wow, I'm getting echoes of Mary Barra there a little bit and what she did at GM. So
yeah, that'll be me, the next Mary Barra. You'll see me on Squawk.
Great.
Well, Peter, thank you for joining us today. And thank you all for tuning in. If you have questions, please leave a comment down below so we can keep the conversation going. We welcome you to connect with us and follow each of us on LinkedIn. And we've included Peter's profile down below as well. So thank you all, everyone. And we'll see you on the next episode of This Side of the Wire.